This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, with the email and online marketing tools small businesses and nonprofits need to promote their organizations. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
Look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to forget Janet Yellen, forget the Fed and macroeconomic policy, forget all of that stuff. You know what interest rates are all about? They're about you, my friend. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups, Epson.com. And by Allianz, serving more than 83 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the United States, AllianzUSA.com. And by Battelle, for 85 years, solving what matters most for consumers, businesses, and the government. Learn more at Battelle.org.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here, everybody. It is the 25th of February today, Wednesday, and Janet Yellen can put Capitol Hill safely in her rearview mirror for about another 6 months or so. The Fed chair wrapped up 2 days worth of congressional testimony this morning, not substantively different from what she said yesterday. The economy's doing all right, and the Fed is content to be patient on interest rates. But after 6-plus years of the main rate that the Fed does control, it's called the federal funds rate, by the way, after 6-plus years of that being basically zero, it's not really a question anymore of if they are going to raise rates, but when it's going to happen. So we are just going to go ahead and add another question to that list. Then what happens? From New York, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts us off.
Federal Reserve, interest rates, blah, blah, blah. What's this mean for me? Come on, that's what you're really wondering, right? Well, the Fed doesn't set all interest rates, but Michelle Girard, chief U.S. economist at RBS, says the rates it does control impact lots of others, either directly.
It becomes more costly for banks to borrow funds.
Or indirectly.
As banks pass their higher costs on to consumers, it will therefore be more costly for consumers to borrow.
Rates on auto loans, credit cards, adjustable rate mortgages, expect those to tick up. But Girard says, keep in mind, rates will still be relatively low by historic standards, and increases will be gradual, says Ann Owen. She's an economist at Hamilton College.
So the first change will be relatively small.
Owen says maybe a quarter or a half a percentage point, not that noticeable for most people. But she expects the Fed to keep nudging rates up.
And the ultimate change in interest rates is substantial. On average, when the Fed starts raising interest rates, they raise them about 3.75 percentage points, so almost 4 percentage points.
Owen says consumers will notice those increases if they apply for a new car loan or mortgage. But if this all sounds like bad news, hold tight. Ken Kuttner teaches economics at Williams College.
The one thing that personally I'm looking forward to is receiving a slightly higher interest rate on my savings, which has been earning essentially zero for the past 5 years or so.
Interest rates aren't just for borrowing, so savers can finally look forward to some better returns. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One of the things Dr. Yellen and the gang are going to be looking at as they debate interest rate increases is wages. And along those lines, there is news today of pay on the low end. The parent company of TJ Maxx and Marshalls said it is going to boost its minimum pay to $9 an hour in June, then $10 an hour for most workers sometime next year. This comes, of course, on the heels of a similar announcement from Walmart last week. So, signs of market forces at work in the tightening labor market, or just happenstance? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Orthodox economic theory says we absolutely should be seeing wages go up as jobs become more plentiful, unemployment falls, and employers have to compete harder to find and keep workers. Linda Barrington at Cornell's Institute for Compensation Studies says that's definitely part of what's happening with TJ Maxx, Walmart, and the like.
I think that the tightening labor market combined with public pressure combined with the bandwagon effect is driving what we're seeing.
Barrington says if we were seeing a really strong tightening of the labor market now, wages would be rising all the way up the pay scale. Instead, wages, broadly speaking, are stagnant. Arun Ivatori at the National Employment Law Project thinks pressure by labor and consumer advocates is mostly what's driving higher pay. But he says,
part of your business strategy is to have, you know, people who work for you, who consumers like to interact with and who represent your business well, you're going to have to pay a little better.
And will paying a little better entice retail and service workers to jump ship to better paying companies?
I won't jump on the bandwagon at TJ Maxx just because they make more.
Right now, Roderick Livingston is making Florida's minimum wage, $8.05, at a Taco Bell in St. Petersburg.
Where I'm at now, I do like my job as far as my manager and everything. I don't feel like the grass will be greener on the other side.
Livingston just wants the grass to be greener at Taco Bell. Right now, he's active in the labor organization pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers nationwide. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Traders could have just stayed home for all the difference today made in the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's where we are on Greece today. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is said to be looking for domestic political support for an extension of the Greek bailout. Yanis Varoufakis, the finance minister in Athens we've all been hearing so much about, has admitted his country may not be able to make debt payments that are coming due this spring after all. Which leaves us where exactly? Marketplace's Patty Hirsch is here with some perspective. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Kai.
All right, hit me, man. What do you got?
Well, Greece is a bit like the youngest son in the family, right? He's borrowed ridiculous amounts of money to buy a car, go on vacation, start a band, but he's squandered everything and he's crashed the car and he says he just can't pay them back. Sorry. Plus, he's living in the house still and he's not paying rent. So his mom, Angela Merkel, by the way, has had enough, right? Either the kid mends his ways, she says, and gets a job or he's out. But the kid doesn't want to go back to school or curb his lifestyle or learn a trade. So instead, he's enlisting the support of his dad and his siblings, that's France and Spain and the rest of the euro, and he's getting them to guilt trip his mom into cutting him a break. Don't push him, they all say, or he'll leave home and you'll break up our wonderful European family. In other words, this has got nothing to do with economics and everything to do with politics. And that is a problem for everyone.
Patty Hirsch, always with the explainer. Thank you, Patty.
My pleasure, Kai.
Ah, Patty. There is, it's easy to believe, a big tech industry game of keeping up with the Joneses going on in Silicon Valley. Apple's building a whiz-bang new headquarters you might have heard about. Facebook bought up 56 acres for its campus a number of years ago. Now comes Google. The company is expected to lay out its plans this week. Marketplace's Adam Allington explores the history of Silicon Valley and its biggest inhabitants.
It's tempting to look at Apple, Facebook, and Google and say that Silicon Valley would be nowhere without them. But that's not really the case. First, the defense industry moved in, then the semiconductor makers in the 1980s, then the dot-com bubble, and now the mobile internet.
Silicon Graphics has come and gone. Sun Microsystems has come and gone. You know, and companies stepped in to fill their place.
Michael Kasperzek is a city councilman in Mountain View, California, headquarters to 20,000 Google employees. Unlike, say, Ford Motor Company a generation ago, he says companies like Google aren't necessarily as enmeshed in the local economy.
Well, you know, Google doesn't do anything that generates sales tax. We don't tax the internet. We don't tax searches. We don't tax ad revenue.
Unlike previous eras where a company with the size and clout of a Facebook or Google could essentially own a town like Mountain View, that is not the case in 2015.
To call the Silicon Valley communities new company towns may be a bit of an overstatement.
Michael Wu is the dean of the College of Environmental Design at Cal Poly in Pomona.
As much as the high-tech companies might want that level of control, they don't have that level of control. And even some of their own employees, as voters, wouldn't necessarily vote to support what might be in the best interest of the companies.
Wu says the Googles and Apples of the world have largely resisted the urge to throw their weight around in local politics. And to its credit, he says Google is even talking about ways it might create new affordable housing for its employees. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The stories we've been doing the past couple of weeks about water, it's our series called The High Price of Cheap, has been mostly about water used in one way or another for consumption, drinking water, agriculture, and irrigation. Today, well, we're going to do what happens on the other end. And when I say it's not a pretty picture, I'm not even talking about what you think I'm talking about. From Baltimore, Maryland, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
First, a warning. This story is a little icky.
You know, you can see that toilet paper around the rim and maybe like a latex glove.
I'm in Baltimore's Gwynn's Run Stream with Michael Flores of the nonprofit Blue Water Baltimore. He's giving me what he calls his sewer tour. The city pipes are so old and cracked that rainwater gets in. The sewers fill up and the contents spit out the manhole covers and into streams.
You can smell it. You can see the sort of the bluish, whitish, cloudy flow of the stream that's totally unnatural and looks just like raw sewage,
which dumps directly into Baltimore Harbor.
That includes a whole sort of mix of different nasties, waterborne diseases like hepatitis and staph and cryptosporidium.
Chances are your city has the same issues. You've heard about bridges collapsing. Well, this is the invisible infrastructure crisis below. Baltimore's story goes back a century. And it begins, sorry, with a putrid harbor. Here's one newspaper's olfactory description.
It is a 2,000-horsepower smell that lays Limburger cheese in the shade.
Urban historian Chris Boone wrote an academic paper on Baltimore sewer history. He's dean of sustainability now at Arizona State.
Baltimore Harbor was the toilet of the city. Everything would flow down into the harbor. So everything that was coming from overflowing cesspools or privies.
Translation, outhouses and human waste pits.
Everything that was coming from the streets.
But Baltimore had no money to build a sewer system. Couldn't raise it, couldn't borrow it. Private interest opposed change. Sound familiar? Then came the Great Baltimore Fire. In 1904, one of the worst fires in U.S. urban history torched 1,500 buildings downtown. The crisis created opportunity.
That fire, what it did, similar to the Chicago Fire of 1871, I think gave the city and also residents a chance to rethink, how do we regrow the city in a way that was even greater than before?
They found the resources. Lawmakers put up money, the voters approved a bond initiative, and Baltimore built a state-of-the-art sewer system completed exactly 100 years ago. Out went the stink, and in came thousands of miles of pipes. Typhoid was eradicated. Now, to understand this progress, you have to step inside the system's treatment plant.
All the Baltimore County and Baltimore City, when they flush, that's what is coming in.
Plant engineer Dan Latova shows me raw sewage entering a pipe 7 feet in diameter. It floats past a series of bars, like jail cell bars, to separate out the debris.
Those bars, they protect the 2x4s and all that not to come through, that's all.
Oh, otherwise it's
Sometimes you get bicycle come through.
Yeah, sometimes mice come through. Then it goes into a tank for, here come the euphemisms, settling sludge and removing solids. The plant removes chemicals and nitrogen and then bleaches and dechlorinates the water before sending it back out into the river. It's amazing what you get for your sewer bill. That is, when the pipes work. 100 years later, as one industry person put it, it's like inheriting your great-grandfather's car. Replacing all this will cost an estimated $1 trillion nationwide.
It's like a time bomb. This old infrastructure, we know it's going to fail. The question is where and when.
Rudy Chow runs the Baltimore Public Works Department. Jackhammers throughout the city are digging up streets to replace collapsed pipes. The oldest are made of wood and terracotta. The feds are imposing clean water deadlines. It all costs money that Baltimore doesn't have. It's lost 300,000 taxpayers and ratepayers to urban flight in a generation. Again, historian Chris Boone.
There was no anticipation of deindustrialization, no anticipation of riots in the 1960s or the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s. All these things, and then the suburbanization of individuals looking for better schools, none of that was in the cards.
The other problem? The city didn't charge high enough rates to maintain the system. Economist David Zetlin is author of Living with Water Scarcity.
Politicians always complain we can't raise prices because we'll get political opposition. The most common problem with the water system is that they're not taking enough money in to pay for the system repair and maintenance that matters over a 50-year cycle.
And now, Public Works Director Chow says the bill is due.
Raising the water rates is inevitable. I think it's going to continue, but it really comes down to the pace of increases.
Baltimore's plan is to spend more public money on preventive replacement and less on emergencies. Now, the challenge is to hike rates, to go to the people and convince them of the miracle that occurs when you flush. But change will not come fast or easy. In Baltimore, try to win over 40-something Danielle Miles. Last spring in a downpour, she drove home after work.
I noticed the sanitary sewer manhole had water coming up, and at that point in time, I knew that my basement was flooded.
Flooded for the third time in 3 years. Every big rain, the neighborhood sewer system fails. Miles walked in, went down the basement, and she saw.
Raw sewage all throughout. It was maybe about, what's this, about a foot?
Yeah.
One step. And it was just rising.
She put on her rain boots and waded over to the source, the bathroom.
Just pouring out of my toilet. It was coming up in my stand-up shower, gushing up.
One street over, an upright freezer was floating upside down in the home of Anita Moore and her parents. Wedding albums were destroyed.
My parents been married for 58 years, and you can't replace any of those photos and all our baby pictures.
All gone.
We still have marks on the wall, everything.
Now the rainy season is coming again, and she has no idea if anything's fixed. Now the city says, yes, it is in the long-term strategy. This is the price of a century of neglect, and it may take another crisis on the order of a city burning down to get the public's attention again. In Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it is the largest underground industrial park in the world.
Subtropolis, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 15 points today. That's less than a 0.1% for the blue chips, closed at 18,224. The NASDAQ gave back less than a point, just a tiny fraction, 49.67. The S&P 500 off a point, less than a 0.1%. Ended things at 21.13. From the energy sector, Chesapeake Energy said profits missed expectations and that it's going to cut spending and the number of oil rigs it has on account of how low crude prices are. Chesapeake shares took a dip down 9%. Shares in SM Energy, though, up 14% today after saying pretty much the same thing about its spending and rigs. I love capitalism. Seems fewer people than expected gave at-home soda machines for gifts over the holidays. Can't imagine why. SodaStream International said its revenue last quarter thus missed estimates. Shares bubbled down 8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times. Prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations of all types and sizes maximize one of their biggest investments, their workforce. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. By Nuance Power PDF, designed for easy implementation to accurately convert, combine, and collaborate on business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at Marketplace or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff in January than they did in December? The Labor Department issues its Consumer Price Index. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for January. And what's for dinner tomorrow? No ideas? Well, it's National Chili Day. You're welcome. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The best record in the National Hockey League, based on total points now, belongs to the Nashville Predators. They are also about to do something a little bit unusual, the Predators are. In a letter to season ticket holders not too long ago, the team said it might stop selling individual tickets to certain games and would pay a premium to buy back some of the tickets it's already sold. Not, on the face of it, a conventional business model, but then again, sports never is. From WPLN, Emil Moffitt explains this is all about home ice advantage.
At a game in early December, Greg Atwood arrived at a seat just like he normally does.
I typically get there right at face-off. And when I walked in, it was when it was dark. And when they turned the lights on, it was pretty shocking just how much. I mean, it was a majority red.
That red was a sea of Chicago Blackhawks fans in T-shirts and sweaters supporting their team. Thousands of fans chanted, "Let's go Hawks." As a reliable Preds fan, Atwood has been coming to games for 14 years and says he actually doesn't mind seeing out-of-towners. He says 1,000 or 2,000 opposing fans are okay, but when they fill up half the arena, that's where he draws the line.
The Preds, a steal by Hossa, heading for the empty net. Hawks win! Hawks win! 71 seconds to go. Marian Hossa gets his second of the game.
It was a rare home defeat for the Predators, and team president Sean Henry says the complaints came flying in from players and from fans.
After that game, I probably got, 50, 75 emails, 10, 12 phone calls, and people were saying, I don't know if I want to come to the game anymore.
So now the team is outlining steps to maximize the Predators' gold and navy blue in the stands. The team says it's considering a mandate that season ticket holders clear it with them before reselling their tickets. The team is also offering to buy back tickets to certain games at 10% above face value.
The first opportunity and last opportunity to buy Predator tickets should stay right here in our greater market.
Unlike goods that can be bought and resold, many professional teams consider their tickets non-transferable licenses. The New England Patriots took the online site StubHub to court a few years back over the resale of tickets. And just last year, the Seattle Seahawks tried to ban anyone with a California zip code from buying a ticket to the NFC Championship game, in what some say was an effort to keep San Francisco 49ers fans out. If the Predators end up doing something similar, not only would that keep out-of-town fans away from the arena, it would likely keep them out of Nashville altogether, meaning downtown restaurants and hotels might lose out. John Fleming is manager of the Renaissance Nashville.
I had two reactions. One as a fan, and I said, absolutely right. Best thing we could do, protect our home ice and go for it.
But as someone running a hotel?
We'll lose some business, obviously, if we do limit that. And it means we'll just have to go find other business.
Season ticket holders are conflicted, too. Greg Atwood may not like half the arena filled with rival fans, but he also doesn't want the team to go overboard with the new rules.
I spent a lot of money on these tickets, and, you know, when I buy these tickets, they're mine to determine what I do with them.
The Predators say they're most concerned with building a championship franchise and a regional fan base that'll last for generations. They say keeping home ice advantage is a key to moving in that direction. In Nashville, I'm Emil Moffitt for Marketplace.
Here with today's random but still kind of interesting business and economic fact of the day. Just about 10% of all the commercial real estate in Kansas City, Missouri is underground, and not by accident either. Patrick Clark wrote about it for Bloomberg Business in a piece called Welcome to Subtropolis. Patrick, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
This is a crazy story, man. Tell me, first of all, what this place is.
It is called Subtropolis, and it is the largest underground industrial park in the world. It's about 55 million square feet, 100 feet underground Kansas City, and currently home to 52 tenants who take up almost as much floor space as in the Pentagon.
Okay, now why? Why does this place exist?
Right, because they're mole people. So I think there's three reasons why you would rent space underground. Climate is a big one.
Is it cold down there? It must be cool, right?
Yeah, mid-60s and overcast is what they say. It's 68 degrees is what the temperature is. So you don't have to heat it. You don't have to cool it. And if you are warehousing film or paper or cheese, for that matter, it preserves whatever you've got down there.
I love that the Postal Service uses it to warehouse stamps.
That's the second why, I think, which is security. Subtropolis is the distribution hub for every stamp that the U.S. Postal Service prints. Maybe not. Yeah. Maybe it's not every stamp, but it's their main distribution.
Hundreds of millions, you say, in a piece.
Hundreds of millions, which translates into millions of dollars. So the fact that it's 100 feet underground and there aren't a lot of ways in or out makes it a safe place to keep all of that postage.
Yeah. You said there were three reasons. Security, climate, and what else?
Well, and space. You know, you can't get 500,000 square feet many places, and you can't get it for half the price that you could otherwise.
Do you know what, like, the rents are down there and everything?
I can tell you what they are, which is about $2.25 a square foot.
Which compares how to, like, on the surface Kansas City space.
Which is about half of what you might pay on the surface. And, of course, there's a lot of space to be had. There's about 8 million square feet of space, which is either available or can be available within 6 months if you ask them to knock out some more walls.
Do you get claustrophobic? I mean, there's no windows. It's all fluorescent light, you know.
Do you get claustrophobic in a office building in Midtown Manhattan? Might be.
No, but I've got
windows,
you would
answer that
man.
Question.
I can see that. And I know I'm not 400 feet underground or whatever it is.
Right. Well, no, that's true. So, you know, if I was trying to rent you a space down there, I'd tell you that the ceilings are 17 feet high.
Right.
And you'd never notice you're underground. The walls are carved out of limestone deposits, and they're not polished to a sheen by any means. So it's certainly a rough hone kind of working environment. On the other hand, if you are renting warehouse space, you know, you're not looking for the finest of finishes.
Patrick Clark is a writer for Bloomberg. His piece on Subtropolis down below Kansas City is at Bloomberg.com. Patrick, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Final note today, which comes with two observations. Observation number one, Warren Buffett is about to issue his 50th annual letter to investors in his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway. Mr. Buffett's observations, as you may know, are always a highlight of the financial year. Observation number two is that he has reached the 50th annual letter because he is 84 years old. But he apparently, and these are his words, courtesy of Fortune magazine, one of the richest men in the world eats, and this is a quote, like a six-year-old. He has five Cokes a day, Warren Buffett does. Sometimes they're cherry Cokes, in case you're curious. He eats Utz's potato sticks, that's S-T-I-X, with those Cokes whenever he wants. And for breakfast, I'm not kidding, he has chocolate ice cream. He does also own $16 billion worth of Coke stock, Mr. Buffett does, and he's thinking about buying Utz's. So there you go.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. In today's uncertain markets, institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price to find global investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online, with six start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers designed for home and offices and work groups. Epson.com.
I'd weigh like 250 pounds if I like heated, by the way, just for the record. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 15 points, that's less than a 10%. The NASDAQ gave back less than a point. The S&P 500 also off about a point. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.